Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. It is Thursday, the 23rd of March. You're listening to KFM. It's Caoimhe Harney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Professor Brian Nolan. He's Deputy Dean in the Faculty of Science and Health and Professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. Is time travel possible? Well, we'll find out what science has to say about that. Then we'll speak to Dr. Florence LeBaron Earle, teacher in French and Technology at the University of Limerick. What we say and how we behave is influenced by cultural norms and can lead to critical and sometimes funny incidents. Then we'll speak to Paul O'Connogh, travel editor of the Irish Independent. 21 expert travel tips to save money on your holidays this year, and he'll be telling us all about that. And then last, we'll speak to Nat O'Connor, policy specialist at Age Action Ireland. A new study has found that fewer than 1 in 4 people are prepared to work longer in exchange for a larger state pension. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, 045 898 999. That's our landline number here. If you want to email me, it's studio at kfmradio.com. Or, of course, you can send me a text or WhatsApp.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Time travel, is it possible? Here's what science has to say about it, because many researchers have highlighted the existence of systems incorporating self-consistent time travel since the 1990s. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Professor Brian Nolan. He's Deputy Dean in the Faculty of Science and Health and Professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. Good afternoon, Professor Nolan.
Afternoon, Caoimhe. How are you?
Brian, I suppose it's something that fascinates most people, especially me. People always ask me if I had 3 wishes, what would I wish for? And I swear, time travel is something that I would love to be able to do. Is it possible, Brian?
Yeah, well, first off, we need to distinguish between travelling in time into the future and into the past. These are very, very different. Now, of course, we always think in terms of travelling into the past, time travel into the past, because that's how we could go back in time and pick the right winning lottery numbers and all sorts of things like that. Time travel into the future, oddly enough, actually is possible and happens all the time. This stems from Einstein's special theory of relativity, which tells us that once two people or bodies are moving relative to one another, their clocks run at different rates. So, in fact, time travelling into the future, which is a consequence of our clocks ticking away at different rates. So, for example, what might be an hour for you is only, if I am moving really, really quickly, an hour for you could, in theory, be 5 minutes for me. So if I return to meet you after what has been an hour for you, but was only 5 minutes for me, that's essentially me travelling into the future, because it took me just 5 minutes to travel 1 hour into the future. So time travel into the future on tiny, tiny microscopic scales is actually possible. But that's no fun. You can't travel into the future and, you know, win the lottery or something like that.
I was going to say, yeah, because I think most of our listeners here are thinking, well, how do I do that so I can go ahead to Saturday night and pick out the winning numbers?
Exactly. Yeah.
I have to say, Brian, I did English in university, so yeah. I'm not mathematically minded or very sciencey. So this is all a little bit, very in-depth for me. But I suppose when you talk about Einstein and Gödel, they were good friends, and they spoke about this a lot, didn't they?
Exactly, yes. So Kurt Gödel was a Hungarian mathematician, philosopher, who, as with many Jewish people in the 1930s, moved to the US because obviously conditions in Europe were not good for Jewish people at that time. And he ended up working in the same institution as Einstein and became very interested in Einstein's theories of general relativity and special relativity. So it was Gödel, really, who came up with the first scientific description of time travel into the past. So working with Einstein's theory of gravity, which tells us about the structure of space and time, Gödel in 1949 came up with this remarkable result that a particular model, mathematically defined universe, does allow for time travel into the past. And ever since then, it's I think it's fair to say that physicists have been kind of scratching their heads, wondering where this effect comes from, and if it's something that can be possible in our universe, rather than this very theoretical mathematical model that that Kurt Gödel described in the 1940s.
Okay, so he's saying that potentially it is possible, but maybe not on this Earth then, Brian, is it?
Precisely, that's exactly it, Cuiva. Yeah, that's it, bang on. So, I mean, this is often the case with scientific theories. Is if they're pushed to their limits, we find some quite unusual effects. And the real question for scientists then is to ask and resolve the question of, well, are those really weird, unusual effects, are they actually possible in the universe that we live in rather than one that lives in a mathematics book? And some unusual results have come up in relation to this. So as you mentioned at the beginning there, from the 1990s, physicists like Kit Thorne, who won the Nobel Prize there a few years ago, and Stephen Hawking, one of the best-known scientists of the modern era, asked these questions. And they were asking from the perspective of looking at the laws of physics and saying, OK, let's forget for the moment that, you know, our technology is limited. Let's ask, what could a really advanced civilization do? Let's say an advanced civilization, maybe human civilization, hundreds or thousands of years from now, that has come up with amazingly efficient ways of producing energy and has come up with amazing technology that allows us to travel at vast speeds and maybe even build wormholes to allow us to travel across the universe. What are the fundamental limitations from the laws of physics that tell us what's possible and what's impossible? With that research, they came up with some quite surprising results, again, kind of reinforcing some of Gödel's ideas that, in theory, this time travel to the past isn't ruled out. So the question then is, well, what happens if we do travel to the past? What kind of things can we encounter? And there's fundamental contradictions that we encounter. So a couple of the commonest things that people discuss are this idea of going back in time and, you know, filling out a winning lottery ticket because you waited till the draw on Saturday night and then you popped into your time machine and you went back to Saturday morning and you filled out the winning numbers. The other thing, and that's, you know, that's fine and well, there's consistency there. In some sense, you all along in some version of that Saturday, you knew what the winning lottery numbers were. But it's easy to encounter highly contradictory situations. The most famous of these is sometimes called the grandmother paradox, yes, or the grandfather paradox, where one travels back in time to when your grandparent was a young child, perhaps, and for whatever reason you may have, you decide to kill them.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty grisly. This is the way scientists think or describe things. I suppose to try and make it vivid as to the difficulties. And you can see the difficulty there. If your grandparents didn't survive childhood, how did they meet their spouse? How was your parent born? How were you born? And yet somehow you were there at the point that you interrupted this timeline.
Okay.
So we're familiar with these kind of things from Marvel films and from the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, these kind of things. And indeed, fiction and the movies often provide us with very nice examples to, I suppose, provoke thinking about the science of the situation.
Okay. Brian, am I right in saying it was Stephen Hawking who did an experiment where he held a party but didn't send the invites until a few days later? I remember hearing that somewhere, sometime.
That's right. So Hawking was very much against the idea of time travel. And you have the story exactly right. Yeah, he ran this experiment to test if time travel was indeed possible. So he held a party and sent out the invitations a week after the party. Now, of course, nobody showed up because nobody knew about the party. And he claimed this as evidence that time travel wasn't possible. He also has another very nice and I think a very nice phrase. I mean, he's an excellent writer, an excellent communicator of science. And this one really captures some of the thinking about time travel. He said that we have lots of evidence that time travel to the past isn't possible. And that evidence is the fact that we don't have visitors from the future arriving, popping, materializing, you know, in our lives from thousands of years from now. So he was, you know, I suppose it's slightly tongue-in-cheek when he said this, but it shows up some of the truth of the matter, that it does seem like nobody in the near future has built time machines, and that's some kind of evidence that whatever the fundamental physics says about the possibilities in these very strange limiting situations, the technology isn't going to be appearing anytime soon.
Well, so go ahead.
And so it looks like bad news for people who are planning their financial futures about winning the lottery, winning the national lottery by travelling back in time. It doesn't seem to be possible.
Yeah, that's usually the main thing that people want time travel for.
It is. Yeah.
For me, Brian, now, I'd love to go back and just experience other periods in time. You know, like, now I think I'd have to be invisible because, you know, it would be a bit weird if I showed up in a pair of jeans in the 1600s, you know.
It probably wouldn't go down well. For you, Caoimhe. They would have taken to whatever about anybody, but I think women in particular showing up in a pair of jeans that might not have ended happily.
No. And
thinking at the time.
Yeah. To be honest, you know, look, 200-300 years ago, would we have thought that we'd have a plane, or would we have thought we'd have motor cars, or every person would drive a car or smartphones? So you just never know, Brian. Sure, you don't.
You don't. And this is the I suppose the starting point for some of this scientific research to ask, well, what are the limitations? What's in some remote future theoretically possible versus what's absolutely ruled out by the laws of physics? And that's where a lot of the, I suppose, the scientific work is focused on, trying to figure out what we can rule out and what we can't rule out.
Very interesting. That is Professor Brian Nolan there, Deputy Dean in the Faculty of Science and Health and Professor in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. Thanks very much, Brian.
Thank you very much, Caoimhe.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Talk soon.
Bye.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, there's very little that is certain in this world, but save for the fact that your holiday will be more expensive this year, unfortunately. And joined now on the line by Paul O'Kanila. He is a travel editor at the Irish Independent. He's going to give us his expert travel tips to save money on your holidays this year. Good afternoon, Paul.
Caoimhe, how are you?
Not too bad. Listen, I suppose it's coming around to that time of year now. Some people, maybe if they're organised, already have their travel plans in place. But for the less organised people like myself, probably no one has their travel plans in place.
I'm the same. Look, I just got the flight done this week and I'm moving on to the accommodation next week. And you would think I'd be the first one to... I'd be here sort of smugly telling you I had mine booked in 2019 or something. But look, there's a lot of us in this situation and the prices are going up all the time. And the golden rules when it comes to saving money with travel are generally book early. Mm. You know, there's lots of reasons for that, that you can get low deposits and you can spread your payments out. And you usually get the pick of the rooms and the pick of the flights. Whereas the closer you get to the summer holidays in particular, the slimmer the pickings are and the higher the prices are. And we all know that's happening this year. But a few tips I can give you, whether you're thinking of short trips or whether you're thinking of summer holidays. And one is to look at booking the hotels directly. If you're thinking of a package holiday, that gives you lots of protections, particularly if you're spending a lot of money on it. But if you're thinking of a short break here at home, use booking.com and use hotels.com by all means to do your search. But get onto the hotel before you press book, because booking directly with them will save them about a 15% or higher fee with the online travel agents. And they will often return that to you in part with a 10 euro night discount or a glass of bubbles on arrival or better cancellation terms or things like that.
Paul,
so
I was only saying this to someone in work that usually if you go direct to the hotel, like, you'll get the same price and you'll get breakfast included as well or something like that. Or you might even get it cheaper with breakfast included.
Yeah, and there's a few different things going on. You're more valuable to them as a direct booking. They'll have your email and they can kind of, down the road, you might develop this kind of whole customer loyalty thing going on. But just up front, it saves them that booking.com fee.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid to ask for it back. A lot of hotels, as we know, the rates are going up, but where they'll try and show value to us this year is by packages and by bundling a dinner or an activity or maybe a spa treatment or maybe things like a late checkout. Or I've even seen some bigger hotels around Ireland doing resort credit style stuff, which is basically where they would say you might have 30 euro to spend on site.
Okay.
So don't be afraid, particularly if you're a family or you're going for a number of different nights don't be afraid to get on the phone. Don't do it all online, where it's so easy to do it all online. But just get on there and say, look, what's the best you can do? Is there anything you can add on for that? Ask those kind of gentle questions. You've just nothing to lose.
Mm. Okay, so if someone is thinking of going further afield then, maybe abroad, you're saying track the exchange poll. What does that mean?
So this is, and I'm kind of, I have on independent.ie a list of about 21 tips, I think it is, to try and squeeze pennies here and there and everywhere. So not every one of them will work for everybody, but here's an idea. If you're not set on a destination, if you don't have to go to the Algarve or the Canaries and you have a bit of flexibility or you like to try new places, have a look at what your euro will buy you on the ground. It's going to be really different looking at Norway or looking at Denmark and then looking at somewhere like Poland, for example. And it's going to be very different looking at Singapore versus Vietnam. Your euro won't go far at all in Singapore. And what you could, you know, what you'd spend on a simple lunch on the side of the street in Singapore could buy you just an unforgettable dinner in Vietnam. So it's just basically looking at the value of your money at the moment. It's one reason why Americans are just, when they come over to Ireland, it's just like they're making hay here because their dollar is going so far. But I was in the States before Christmas. I was nearly crying every time I had to get the phone out to pay for stuff because it was basically parity at that time. But I think it's a euro to $1.07 now. So that's what I mean by that.
Okay, perfect. Now, you're saying travel off peak. Not always, you know, not everyone's able to do that, but it is a lot cheaper to do that, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like, let's call that a golden rule. If you have kids like myself, you kind of want to punch someone when they tell you to travel off peak because you know it's much easier said than done. But if you have the flexibility, the fares will drop significantly. Even if you look at Easter and look at a Ryanair or Aer Lingus flight to somewhere popular like Faro or Malaga during the Easter break, and look at it the week after, and just see how much they plummet. If you have that kind of flexibility, it makes sense to work with it and book your holidays with it. But even if you have to travel in peak, have a look at travelling midweek rather than on the busy Saturdays or Sundays when all the charters go. Have a look at working around the fringes of demand on flights that might leave earlier or later in the day that might be less desirable for people because of the early starts or late arrivals. What I've done this year is trim down the length of time we're spending overseas. So we were looking at 12 nights and we've decided to go at 7 and we're going to spend a little bit more on a nicer place. But we still end up spending less overall, if you know what I mean, on our holiday. And I think a lot of people are kind of cutting corners like that, splashing, but for less time, or going for 7 rather than 14 days, that kind of thing. So that's all ways of travelling around. We get into this whole 1 week, 2 week, July and August mentality, but there are ways around it because even tour operators and travel agents these days work so much with scheduled flights that there's no particular reason you have to go Saturday to Saturday.
Absolutely. An interesting one, use Ryanair's Fare Finder. Can you explain this one to me, Paul?
So this is a tool on Ryanair's website. The easiest way to look at it is on the desktop site. There's a tab at the top on the menu bar at the top called Plan. Click on Plan and go down and you'll see under an Explore section there's Fare Finder, and you go into that and it'll present you with a little box and a couple of options on the screen. You basically choose your budget. So you could say 100 euro or 150 euro or the lowest option is 20 euro or less. So I clicked on that yesterday morning just to have a look. Again, if your dates are flexible, you'll get the best routes. But I could see flights to places like Leipzig to Biarritz from $17.99 one way. So it's a good way to find if you don't have to go, you know, 7th to 14th of June. If you're a bit more flexible and you can fool around with your annual leave and your dates and you don't mind where you go, that come back to that again. Have a look at that tool. And it brings to mind another tip actually, which is it's useful in the first year or two of a new route to have a look at it, because it's people are, we tend to be quite safe when we go with our summer holidays and go with what we know.
Yes.
But Ryanair has new routes to places like Puglia in Italy, to northern Spain, a new one to an airport near Valencia. And the prices on those are considerably lower than they would be for Malaga or Faro, the real sun holiday hotspots. So while people aren't familiar with them, have a look. Again, okay. I suppose that plays into the hands of someone who wants to be a little bit more adventurous. But
of course. Lastly, Paul, because we're a little tight on time, but yeah. Take a night train, which is so interesting because trains across Europe are fabulous to take, but people often don't consider them.
Yeah, and I think this is probably best suited to someone who's rough and ready with a backpack or not with six children in tow. Because the reason I'm suggesting night trains, twofold. One, they're on the up, and there's a really cool selection of new night trains have launched over the last couple of years during the pandemic and since. Austria's Nightjet is a good example, but there's loads more. And if you book smartly and you travel on a sleeper train overnight, you can save yourself the cost of a hostel or a hotel stay. Now, it's not going to be the same as having your own bed. You might get a couchette, you might splash out on bunks, and you will have a tiny sink, and you may have to share a bathroom and all of that. But there is a kind of a... Some people find it depends on the person. Some people sleep well on the move and they like the romance of railway travel, and they like getting chatting to people on the train, and they really feel like they're in the journey and they have that lovely travel momentum going. And others just want to get out to A to B as quickly as possible and have a nice comfy bed. So it depends on the kind of travel you are. One tip I'll give you, if you are thinking of train travel, there's a brilliant website called Seat61.com, run by one guy who's just a complete ultimate train nerd, and he has every route and price plotted out in it.
Well, wow, okay. Seat61.com. Of course, you can find all of those expert travel tips, 21 in total, on the Irish Independent, and that is travel editor with the Irish Independent, Paul O'Kanila. Thanks very much, Paul. Now, what we say and how we behave is influenced by cultural norms and can lead to critical and sometimes funny incidents. So I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Florence LeBaron Earle. She's a teacher in French and technology at the University of Limerick. Good afternoon, Dr. Florence.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to have you on. You say here in your article that you were proposed to by someone you barely knew.
Indeed, yeah. I was on the first date with an Irish lad, and I'm originally from France, so I was a bit confused sometimes by the Irish saying, the Irish language, the Irish English language. It was a bit unknown to me. I was still new to the country. And the date was going really well, and I kind of fancied the guy, so I really wanted him to ask me out. But after we exchanged our numbers, basically he said, "I'll give you a ring."
Okay.
And I completely misunderstood the fact that you just was going to call me on the phone. I thought ring is proposing to me.
Okay, because to be honest now, Florence, I was thinking to myself, like, she'll have to give a few tips to the Irish women, because generally Irish men wouldn't be that quick to get down on one knee, I would say.
I learned the hard way. It took him a few years to actually propose after that.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. So what year did you move over to Ireland?
I moved to Ireland in the year 2002, so quite a while now.
Okay, so you arrived in Shannon Airport, and you were kind of baffled at the different phrases that you heard. What's the crack? Tis grand, sure. And different kind of little words that we use. Tell us a little bit about that.
Exactly, yeah, because in my home country, I did learn English. I did a degree in university in English, so I thought I would be able to speak fluently in an Irish English speaking country. But as soon as I arrived, I realized that it was not going to be the case. And like you said, all these beautiful expressions that I've come to love now were totally unknown to me. And what's fascinating is just that these expressions, it's not just a different language, but they also carry culture. And that's what I talk about in the article. It's this concept of lingua culture. So the way we do things has an influence on the words we use, and the word we use also reflect the way we do things. So it's kind of like, you know, the egg and the chicken, which came first.
Mm.
And there's so many stories, so many anecdotes, but one I really love is about tea, because you love tea in Ireland.
Mm.
You love the drink, obviously, and it needs to be a specific type of drink. But there's also another meaning. When you say tea, it can mean like a meal, a light meal maybe, or a snack.
Yes.
And I never came across the word tea meaning this before. And I have a funny, actually, anecdote about this, because as a French person, a lot of the friends that I made through the years were expecting, you know, amazing food, like maybe a three-dinner course made by the French friend. But I would invite them for tea, thinking like a lemon-flavored hot water, you know, and maybe a biscuit, because
yes,
that's what tea is in France. and they would be arriving starving, expecting a bit of a meal, maybe a quiche or something like that.
Okay.
And it took me a while to realize, why are they starving? And another thing that is fascinating is Irish people, you are so polite.
Yes.
And they would never tell me in my face, do you have anything else to eat? So I could see there was something strange going on, but I couldn't put my finger on it. It just took me a good few years before I realised I was really making a faux pas there.
And I see as well in the article that, for one example then, you were in on post, an employee called you love about five or six times in a brief stamp buying transaction. Do you live in Limerick, or was this in Limerick, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, so at the time I was living in Limerick, yes.
Yeah.
And I was just taken aback because this person that I've never met in my life called me love. And, you know, it's very obviously, usually you use that word in my culture to someone you really know very well. Mm. Or maybe a loved one or like a boyfriend or girlfriend. So I was really taken aback and I was wondering what was going on. I just could not understand. I just came here to buy a stamp and this person in front of me calls me love five or six times. Like, there you go, love. What can I do for you, love? Here's your stamp, love. I was really even wondering, did I hear this right? And you just look around, everybody is not flinching. It's totally normal. So I was, I had to explain, have an explanation with my housemates afterwards, and they explained to me, it's just the way we talk here.
Yeah, it's interesting because I actually studied in the University of Limerick myself as well, Florence.
Thank you.
And I found Limerick people tend to use love a lot, much more than I would say in my county here in Kildare. Dublin people, I would say, use love a lot, but definitely down in Limerick, I find that they use it quite often. Obviously, you understood then that it was just a turn of phrase, but it's quite funny how culture can even change from just county to county here in Ireland.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You have this linguistic variation, and that's the beauty of culture. You know, it's so varied. Within one country, you can so many cultures, but we forget sometimes that culture, it's not just, you know, one country, one county. It can be as small as a family. Culture is something that is shared, so it takes as little as two people to make a culture. So I'm not surprised that you say that maybe from Kildare you speak a certain way and then in Limerick another way.
Yes.
And that's what's fascinating. That's why my job is about, to observe languages, how it's used in society. But it's definitely been a really steep learning curve when I first came in Ireland.
And tell me, in comparison to France, what do you think the biggest culture shock was?
Oh my gosh, that's a very good question. The biggest culture shock.
Sorry for putting you on the spot now.
There's so many little anecdotes, but I suppose it is the way that people don't speak directly to you.
Mm.
They are, and I've learned with the year that it's about face value, it's about politeness, but just the rules are different. Obviously, we have face value and we have politeness in France, but just the rules are different here, and people don't want to put you out or don't want to sound rude. And I just found it very, very baffling that people can't tell you no in your face. Okay, so something as simple as, oh, would you like to come watch a movie on Friday night?
Yes.
And I'm just talking about housemates, like not even a date or anything. And they just could not say no.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just, I'll check my schedule or I'll get back to you. I get back to you is one that comes a lot,
okay.
But they never get back to you.
Whereas in France, it would be just no, and you wouldn't be offended by that.
Not at all, no. Actually, I've been told that people, the default answer is no, and then they, even if they're interested, it's quite the opposite. But, you know, they'd be more direct, yes.
Okay.
So that was definitely, and I think still to this day, 20 years later, I'm still struggling sometimes, and I just wonder, is the person trying to be polite, or do they actually have something else to do? And I have to dig a little bit deeper to get an answer.
Yeah, there's a little bit of decoding to be done within the Irish social circles, I think, is there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because I lived abroad for a few years and an American girl said to me, Florence, that Irish people are funny because if they have a problem, they talk about the problem to everyone except the person that the problem involves. And it's actually so true.
I can relate to that, yes.
Florence, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. That's Dr. Florence LeBaron-Earle. She's a teacher in French and technology at the University of Limerick. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney.
Now, one in five women say that a higher state pension would entice them to work for longer. The new research has found, though, that that compares to 26% of men. Now, I'm joined on the line by Nat O'Connor. He's a policy specialist at Age Action Ireland. Good afternoon, Nat.
Good afternoon.
Nat, this new study has found that fewer than one in four people are prepared to work longer in exchange for a larger state pension. Did that come as a surprise to you?
It's not a surprise, but I suppose it perhaps shows that people are not fully aware of the various pension reforms that are being proposed at the moment. So Minister Heather Humphreys has proposed that, you know, up to the age of 70, you could defer the state pension. And if you defer it, which means you wouldn't get any pension for a year or more, you'd get a larger pension then, a bigger weekly amount. And, you know, I think there's an awful lot of detail in this that people would have to sit down and make an individual calculation as to whether or not that makes sense for them. I think that just isn't the awareness of it. But it certainly, it doesn't surprise us that people are not given too much incentive by that, because it's only an additional 15 or 20 euro a year that you'd a week that you'd get if you were to defer your pension. And of course, you'd be giving up on maybe 13,000 euro worth of pension for every year that you defer. So it would take many years for you to get that money back again by deferring. So it's kind of a tricky calculation for people.
Absolutely. And you're working for four more years, which in my from my side anyway, I think, you know, like, it's a lot to give up for a few extra quid, isn't it, Nat?
It is. And I think the whole issue of whether somebody wants to work for longer really should be about the choice and control given to that person to make that decision for themselves. I mean, lots of people do work beyond the traditional retirement age. There's at least 80,000 people who are age 66 and older who are working as employees. There's others who'd be working as business owners or self-employed. So there's really a lot of older people are still at work. That's not unusual. And of course, you can get the state pension and work because it's all taxable income. So people can make that decision for themselves.
Absolutely.
But what we found is that most people would prefer to, you know, have the option of going part-time or transitioning out of work. Whereas the reality is many people face mandatory retirement.
Yeah.
That a clause in your contract that says at the age of 65, in many cases, you simply have to give up your job. And that, we feel, takes away choice from people on the other side of things.
Definitely, it's all about choice, Nat. Is there any thing in place at the moment that would allow people to kind of go part-time while still maintaining some kind of pension, or maybe getting a slightly higher pension at the end of that period?
No, at the moment, there's simply, once you hit your 66th birthday, you're entitled to the state pension. And, you know, if you're already earning good money, then you obviously would be paying tax on the state pension income. But it's, of course, it's additional income that you get. So people choose to do that.
Okay. It's funny because when we talk about the pension age here, I'm sure you're aware that in France there's many strikes. There's actually strikes on as we speak, causing travel disruptions to flights and ferries and train services, because they're increasing their pension age, which is much, much lower than ours, Nat.
Well, it is and it isn't. Well, what we're seeing in France is, I think, a pension age of 62.
Okay.
But it only applies to someone who's actually worked for 42 years solid.
Right.
And made all of their contributions. So really, it's about someone who might have left school and gone straight into work and has worked solidly. But anybody who went to college or did a master's and began work in their mid-20s or a bit later, you know, they wouldn't have the credits to retire in France, and they would be retiring at 65 or even 67, depending on their circumstances. So it's not quite as clear as it might seem.
Okay.
But certainly for people who do have the credits paid, yes, they could have that earlier pension age. And indeed, you know, many European countries would have a larger proportion of older persons than Ireland would. Mm. We're still a relatively young population because of all the migration of people leaving Ireland in the 1970s and 1980s, and that only really stopped in the 90s. So we don't have the same older population that France or Italy or Germany would have. So our ability to pay pensions is there, which is why, you know, Age Action was so concerned to keep the pension age at 66. And obviously that was a big issue at the last general election here.
Okay. It's something that you notice in other countries. Now, I know if you take the likes of America, there's probably a lot more older people working for other reasons rather than that they want to work. Perhaps it's because they have to and out of necessity, Nat. But do we lag behind in terms of people working over the age of 65, 66, or how do we compare to other jurisdictions?
I think, you know, we might have similar numbers of people working, perhaps not as many as in the United States, where the lack of pension coverage and the lack of welfare protection in particular does force people in their 70s and 80s to go out and get work. You know, stereotypes like people, you know, packing bags at the supermarket checkout counter and so on, which is something we don't see here, thankfully. Yeah. But there is a risk. And our biggest concern would be there's a growing number of older people who are renting, private sector renting.
Yeah.
It's about one in every 42 older persons at the moment. And of course, many people have said to us that they're working in their late 60s because they don't know how they're going to pay the rent when they stop working.
Yeah.
And that's going to be an issue because these are people who might, for whatever reason, not have the capacity to buy their own home. But they might not be eligible for local authority social housing either. They're kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah, and then so the state pension obviously wouldn't be suffice to pay their rent, Nat.
Nothing like it.
Yeah.
Nothing like it. So there's a difficulty there. People may have to turn to the state looking for sort of, you know, housing assistance payments to help them make the rent. And so that's an acute issue, and it's going to grow very quickly because there's many people in their 50s and early 60s who are renting. And we're waiting to see the census numbers later this year to get an update on that. But we're pretty confident this is a growing issue, and it will rapidly become something that the government is going to have to do something about.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you see many people coming forward to Age Action about that issue, Nat?
It's an issue that we have. I've talked on the phone to a number of people about.
Okay.
As I say, it's only affecting a minority of older persons, but of course it's concentrated perhaps in urban areas, although there's rural renting as well. And so we don't know enough, but I do know there was a paper recently by the National Economic and Social Council, and this is one of their findings, that the number of people who will rent into older age is only going to grow, and this is an unmet need in terms of public policy, because we don't have the systems in place. We don't have enough social housing, or indeed that kind of mid-level affordable housing that people can get into.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes back to housing usually here, Nat. That is Nat O'Connor, Policy Specialist at Age Action Ireland. And thanks very much, Nat, for your time with that new news about the study that has found that fewer than one in four people are prepared to work longer in exchange for a larger state pension. That's all we have time for today. I want to say a quick happy birthday to my brother Tom, who is 25 years old today. So I couldn't go without saying that to him. And I will be back on Monday, because I'm going to a wedding tomorrow, of course. I'm sure anyone who listens to KFM knows, but I want to say huge congratulations to my best friend Karen and her fiance Rob, who are due to get married tomorrow in Cara, and I'm sure it'll be an absolutely emotional day, love filled, and by this time tomorrow hopefully I will be dancing around Rath Sala.